Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, Gina.
Hi, Ione. Hi, everyone. I'm Gina, the senior editor of Polyester.
And I'm Ione, the founding editor-in-chief of Polyester. And this is the Polyester Podcast, a feminist pop culture podcast dissecting the discourse on a weekly basis. For this special edition of the Polyester Podcast, we are sitting down with writer, editor, and brand strategist Fumi Feto to discuss Welcome Collection's exhibition, The Cult of Beauty. We'll be discussing how the exhibition shines a light on current beauty discourse, as well as exploring how the cult of beauty traces beauty standards across modern history. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very, very well. Very happy to be here with you to talk about this.
I know. What? Where do we start? I mean, let's start with you.
Okay.
Can we please have a little brief introduction to you and your work? Although I'm sure many of our listeners will be familiar.
Oh, goodness. I don't want to take that for granted. how do I begin? Okay. So I'm Fumi Feto. I am a writer and an editor, and I work with lots of brands, as you mentioned. I have a column at The Observer. So I'm a beauty columnist there, but I also do a lot of beauty and art for Vogue, as I'm a contributing editor there. So that's really a sort of a very, very tight roundup of my work. And yeah, as I said, and I work with a lot of beauty brands in terms of strategizing on lots of different things, whether it's marketing or product development or messaging, anything. Really?
I do,
which I've been, it's sort of been sleeping for a while, and I'm not sure when I'm going to wake it up, because it is a lot of work. So I take my hat off to you two.
Oh, thank you.
I don't think people realise how much work goes into putting a podcast together. Yeah, so my podcast really was focused on beauty, but the culture around beauty, and really kind of asking questions about beauty and how we see ourselves, why we want to look a certain way, what has led us to that point, and so on and so forth, and really sort of just pulling that apart a little bit and being really sort of questioning on what we see and the things that we take for granted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really interested in what like led you to beauty as your kind of beat, no pun. No, I didn't mean that as a pun.
But we like it. We take
like
it. The beat, you know, makeup, having a good beat. You know, my foray into beauty was actually totally, totally accidental. Mm-hmm. I was interested in beauty, like, you know, most girls in their teens and so on, you know, would explore and experiment with beauty. But I never really thought about it in terms of going into a career in beauty at all. I wanted to work in magazines, although I didn't study journalism or fashion. I studied finance and then left my job one day and started interning on a fashion magazine. And I was not interested in the beauty pages at all, because nothing in there spoke to anyone who looked like me. Mm-hmm. So it just wasn't even on my radar. And I think it's when I went freelance later on in my career, not so much later on, but still quite early on in my career, then I started writing about beauty. Because, you know, when you're freelance, I think you turn your hand to lots of different things. And I started getting some requests from people to write about beauty as it pertains to people of color. Mm-hmm. And that's really how it sort of started. And it wasn't because I was really that in love with beauty. It was really probably because I was really irritated by the fact that it just wasn't particularly inclusive, and the conversations were so narrow. And also in terms of how beauty is explored, a lot of times it's quite facile, mm-hmm. and it's very superficial. And I kind of wanted to dig a little bit deeper. So it was kind of twofold. And mm-hmm. that's how I sort of ended up going in there. In some ways, I feel like I can be. I mean, I do like beauty and I use it and explore it and so on. But sometimes I feel like I'm sort of an anti-beauty beauty editor.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah. It's definitely similar to our approach towards beauty at Polyester, I think, as well. How do you think kind of like standards have changed over your career of beauty? It's a big question,
Have they changed? I think on the surface, people think things have changed, but actually, I don't think they have. I think what we're seeing is just a different iteration of something that has always existed. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's probably, you know, more aggressive in terms of the pursuit of a certain standard because of social media, because we're sort of plagued by so many different touch points of information. So really, has it changed? I think superficially it's sort of changed. I think maybe in some ways we're sort of more accepting, or we think we're more accepting. And then, you know, you sort of step into real life outside of certain circles and you think, actually, people still think the way they think. They're still, you know, desperately chasing after that body shape or that face shape or that nose shape or that lip. That it's still happening. We can see it. Because if it wasn't the case, we wouldn't have a beauty industry that was so commercially successful. So yeah, I would love to think that our standards have changed and we're just embracing all these other elements of what beauty could be and exploring them in their fullness. But I think we have a long way to go.
Do you think that, I mean, this is like a very big depressing question. Just some warning there. Do you think it's possible to shift them like in any big, meaningful way?
Yes. I think we can. I think it's a big job, but I think we can. But that will have to start with, well, a lot of us who have been exposed to all of these ideas of what beauty is.
So much
what
conditioning.
Yeah, we've been conditioned so much. I think if we actively decide to sort of think about, you know, changing the way that we see beauty and also doing that, not just in terms of what we say, but also in practice as well. So for instance, with me, you know, I really have issues with any sort of creams or things that say anti-aging or anti-wrinkle. I just think there is a real issue with that. And I think to myself, imagine if every single person thought, no, if it says anti-aging or anti-wrinkle, I will not buy it. Mm-hmm. The industry will have to shift to meet that need. So I think that as a consumer, we actually have quite a lot of power to change things. And I think also that, so that's one part with all of us who are already conditioned and so on and have to fight against it on a daily basis. But then when we're looking at the sort of younger generation, and when I talk about younger generation, I'm talking about like the kids, mm-hmm. you know, really small kids, and, you know, thinking about, okay, what sort of conversations you having around them? You know, what are you talking to them about that makes them think that this is what beauty is, or this is what I should aspire to or not aspire to? You know, I have children and, you know, and I'm always having to talk to them about, think of your body in terms of what it does and its functions and how, you know, your body holds your digestive system and your body does this and you're able to do this. And, you know, think of it in that way as opposed to the aesthetics and what that means and putting value on that. And I think if we all can play those roles with different people within our lives and being able to just channel this a different kind of energy around what holds value, I think we can shift it. But I think it's something that we all have to have sort of individual responsibility for. Are we there yet? Are people willing to do that?
Yeah.
To
be a community.
Absolutely.
I don't know if I'm being cynical at all, but I think I've noticed it in the body positive movement for sure, that the advertising companies and like marketing companies, instead of catering to maybe changing attitudes within the public, are just changing the words they use.
Oh, yeah, like, completely.
Skims has come out and it's for smoothing, but that used to be Spanx and it's flattering. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like these big companies aren't going to change what they're flogging or trying to change the way that we see beauty, they're just going to change the words that we use around it so
yeah.
they can continue to diminish people.
Yeah, and I think also fundamentally, in some ways, it's a sort of catch-22 situation, because really, when you think about it, what is the purpose of a company or a business? To make money. Mm-hmm. That is their ultimate goal, to make money. And so, yes, they want to make money in a way that is as, you know, morally justifiable as possible or ethically justifiable as possible. You hope. Mm-hmm. But there are certain things that they will simply do because they're like, well, there's a demand for that. There are lots of, you know, women particularly who mm-hmm. are, you know, desperately looking for things to diminish wrinkles or to smooth so-called, you know, inverted commas, and to, you know, slim them down in a certain way. And so the company's sort of like, well, why shouldn't we respond to that? Women want that. Mm. They don't want to take responsibility for not making women feel, you know, not making them feel like they're less than. They just think, well, if that's what they want, we'll give them that. They don't want to actually change things. This is what I'm seeing. A lot of them don't really want to change things. They want to change things to a certain degree. But when it starts to hit the bottom line, then it's like, oh.
I think okay. it's all about what's profitable. Like, it's interesting yeah. you said about Skims, because we were talking about the Kardashians and like how all of their clothing lines go up to like a 5X or something, which is obviously still quite rare. Mm. And it's like, well, because they know there's a market for it, and that's mm-hmm. why they're doing it. They're mm. not like, you know, like yes, great moral saviors.
But in many ways, I guess we can ask ourselves, does that really matter? Are we expecting too much?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there are, you know, and I remember having this conversation with a makeup artist friend of mine, and we were talking about the fact that so many brands now have come out with sort of, you know, foundations. This was a few years ago, foundations with lots and lots of skin tones. And, you know, we know that a lot of it is performative, because they've suddenly realized, oh, actually, if we do that, we'll make more money. And that's a bit annoying. But we kind of were having this conversation around, well, does it really matter? Is it really important? Are we expecting too much of companies to sort of behave like people and have morals mm-hmm. and have, you know, so I don't know, that's all sort of out there. But fundamentally, they are companies, and their job is to make money. Sadly, that's what it is.
It was interesting in the Cult of Beauty exhibition to kind of see our vision of beauty and standards of beauty mapped to even like pre the rampant kind of yes. like capitalist marketplace yes. we have now, yes. like seeing those like really old paintings and the busts, and like thinking, well, there wasn't a market around this, mm-hmm. but it still existed. Mm-hmm. What were your initial thoughts of like the show? I feel like it's so expansive, it's hard to have just
yeah,
like one
thought.
Yeah,
it is so expansive. I mean, I think what was really interesting for me about the show, well, I mean, it touched so many areas of beauty, you know, over the years and so on. So you see beauty from lots of different touch points and also in terms of different cultures and so on and so forth. But I think the thing that is so interesting to me is this constant pursuit of beauty. Mm. Like, what is it? Like, it's so, you know, it transcends age, it transcends time, it transcends culture, you know, like there's always this pursuit of beauty. And I just, you know, you kind of wonder, you ask yourself that, is it possible to kind of just step away from that, detach yourself from beauty and just devalue it somehow? So I think that was what was just really interesting to me, that regardless, there's always been this pursuit of beauty, regardless of the culture, regardless of time. And, you know, we're still in it now.
I think it's harder now because the seeing beauty as an art and seeing beauty as an industry is too hard to like delineate the difference mm. now. Like, it's too difficult to, and also to see certain things as pandering. Like, there's so much like tokenistic acts within the beauty industry as mm. well, where I find myself recoiling a bit even mm. From those kinds of things, I think. There was a bit in the exhibition as well with the Black Beauty magazines.
Mm, mm.
And what was the title?
It
was like,
it was Inclusive or Othering was like the subtitle for it. Was, I'm not sure if you remember that kind of like display case.
Yes, I
of
do.
Like
yes.
a lot of the pivotal moments of mm. inclusion in like the publishing industry. And I thought that was really interesting, that was its title, that it wasn't necessarily like point blank adoring of those like acts of inclusivity and diversity, because I feel like that's constantly a industry-wide or like society-wide conversation, or within like probably the groups we're in anyway, and like the people we follow on Instagram, like, oh, is inclusion enough? Like, what does it mean? And definitely interested in your thoughts on that as like an editor and a columnist.
So
and all
in
of these
terms
things.
Of all, so just to get this right, so in terms of this distinction between whether it's inclusive or whether it's othering. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there is a fine line there, isn't it? You know, sometimes you feel like there's a sort of tick box that kind of goes on. It's like, oh, let's get a black face in there somehow and so on. And I see that happens with me when people ask me to do certain things, and I can tell the difference whether it's being inclusive and trying to make sure that there's lots of different representations of a particular topic or whatever, or whether it's just a case of, well, this person fits that mold, so we have to put them in there. It's a really, really difficult one. I think it's this idea of how you represent different people. I think it has to be threaded. If we're talking about sort of, you know, with publications or companies or whatever, it has to be threaded right through. You know, it can't be something that you only do at certain points. I mean, even when I think about, you know, going into certain stores and they have, you know, products for sort of black hair, a lot of times they'll sort of put that in the little corner, and that's the sort of ethnic corner, you know, but they will see themselves as being inclusive. But for me, that's othering. You know, at the end of the day, what being inclusive is making everyone feel like they have a, you know, they have a seat at the table. Everyone feels welcome. It's, you know, that's what inclusivity is, and that's everyone. So when you start to sort of put people in these different kind of corners and boxes, then it starts being slightly sort of strange, and then it doesn't feel positive anymore. And sometimes, you know, and back in the day, certainly, I mean, now you see much more inclusivity on covers, but, you know, there's still a little bit of tick boxing that goes on, where it's like, okay, well, we've had this sort of person that looks a certain way, so now we can't do that again. We now have to have, you know, the person who fits the mold. And then maybe at some point we'll, you know, drop that person in. It still goes on a little bit today. We still see that. We definitely still see that. It's not, you know, we're not at the point where it's like, oh, yeah, that's all fine. We've kind of done
that. It's like
that.
Everyone's on an even keel, kind of.
I think it's kind of in the reporting of it as well, because there'll be like the really inclusive issue of XYZ, like, and then it'll become its own news story that they've done that, and that kind of makes it separate. That's
exactly
what makes it other.
It should just be something that we don't even talk about anymore. But sadly, I don't know when we're going to get to that point. But yeah, but I think brands and publications, you know, media publications should really think about that, where they don't make it a thing. It's just, you know, if someone else wants to pick it up and go, oh, they've done XYZ, then fine. But I think when they're representing different sort of categories, just don't make it a thing. It should just be like everything else. You know, when you have a white thin model on there, you don't sort of say, hey, look, you know, we've got a white thin
it's like
model.
The 2000th
you know,
time.
Look, you know, so it, no one should sort of make a thing of it. And if someone wants to have the conversation around it, then fine. But I think that if they stop making such a thing about it, then it will become the norm. I remember working with a brand a few years back, and I said to them, look, your social media is very, very white. I mean, it's just lots and lots of white people. And I said, you need to change it up. You need to reflect your customer base, your consumers, and so on. And they did that for a little bit, and their figures started to dip. And then they sort of flipped back to it being an all-white cast. And I've said, well, why have you changed that? Oh, our figures were dipping, and so it was really difficult. And I said, look, you have to normalize. Mm-hmm. You have to normalize, you know, a black face, someone with a hijab, you know, a brown face. You have to normalize it, you know, and you have to be willing to take the hit. And this is part of the problem. A lot of brands are not willing to take the hit. As I always say, it's like when it starts hitting the bottom line, they're like, whoa, okay, that's maybe a little bit too much for us, you know. So you get some that are sort of trying to push, but it's still not enough.
This is indicative as well of like the type of inclusivity that is very surface level, because you know, like behind that cover or behind that 2 months on Instagram, they don't have any like marginalized people making up the team. Mm-hmm. Or if they do in the team, those people don't have enough of like a power, a voice, exactly, or a sway to exactly actually make any decisions.
Totally. And I think that's a lot of the problem. You know, I always say that, you know, we can talk about inclusivity and diversity and whatnot all day long. I'm always really interested in, you know, who's in the corridors of power, who's making decisions, mm-hmm, you know, who actually has agency to change anything. And, you know, when people sort of say, oh, yeah, we do have, you know, people from marginalized groups in our, you know, in our teams that we hire. But I'm like, yeah, that's great. But do they have any power? Do they have a voice? Because if they don't, then in many ways it's like, yeah, it's nice. But if the power structure still remains the same, then nothing is really, really going to change.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think going back to like you saying that stories are kind of made out of, yeah, like the first black model or the first plus size model, first disabled model. That was like definitely, do you remember that we would never ever theme issues of polyester because like we're so used to being.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns. Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Put in a box anyway. So like around that time when we started 10 years ago this year, it was like when it was like the girl issue of everything. But then it's like, no, but what if these people actually just made something consistently? Yeah. Yes. Like, what would that mean when you can't just like be a headline anymore?
Yes. Yeah.
So moving on, I definitely found the kind of final installation in the exhibition, which was like a recreation of a club bathroom that had like a lot of not interactive elements, like multimedia elements. Is that what, like lots of TikTok TikToks playing, yes, like group chats buzzing. I found that like possibly like one of the most engaging things for me personally. Mm. I'm interested in what you thought of it when you saw it. I think because it was so visceral, yes, like usually you're engaging that content so passively on your phone, you don't even register that you are. Mm-hmm. Whereas put in front of you, I was like, oh,
it's this almost is actually quite a shocking. Lot.
Yeah.
It's quite shocking.
Like, I wish I had this like above my bath.
Yeah. Yeah, it was quite intense. And it sort of, it speaks to the intensity of what we're dealing with on social media right now. I mean, the content is really a lot and it is really, really overwhelming. And it's alarming, I think, in terms of what we're digesting without sort of realizing it. We're so, like, our subconscious is kind of like normalizing the amount of content that is put out there around beauty on social media. And we are absorbing so much of that without sort of realizing. So in the exhibition, when it's sort of presented to you, you're just like, wow. Okay. Like, it does make you think.
And it made me think of like, I'm not sure if you've seen all of the viral stories about 10-year-olds shopping in Sephora, yes, and yeah, like trying to get drunk elephant, yeah, stuff for Christmas and all of that kind of thing.
I mean, how do they even afford it? Drunk elephant is not cheap.
I know, it's so expensive.
I'm like, girl, that. You have more money than I did when I was 10.
Like, I can't even buy one now. I like see those little gift sets. I'm like, please.
It must be especially like jarring for you as a mother then.
You know, I think there are a few things. So on one hand, I think we also, the older lot, as it were, I hate to use that word, but yeah, but we need to think back to, okay, when you were that age, you know, for anyone who was interested in beauty, you were interested. Yeah. You wanted to experiment with things. It's just like you just didn't have the buzzy brands mm-hmm. like the Drunk Elephant, and you didn't have the Sephora. I mean, we had like the local chemist with like really chalky, chalky eyeshadow, and you might get a Rimmel Black Cherry mm-hmm. if you're lucky.
Information either.
We didn't.
Like, you didn't have YouTube tutorials.
Exactly. And that's the difference. We didn't have any of that. So I'm wondering whether that is really just the repercussions of having, you know, you have social media and you have all of this information at your fingertips. You know, it's just everywhere. They're surrounded by it. You know, I have nieces who are, you know, they're just turning sort of teen sort of ages. Yeah, they're about sort of 12 and they're really into beauty. They're really into, you know, all sorts of beauty and fragrance and so on. They're really, really engaged with all of that. Apparently, like, Superdrugs is, like, the place now where everyone hangs out. Never mind Sephora. For all the little ones, that's where they like to hang out. Because also, for the most part, the ones who have only a little bit of pocket money, those are the bits that yeah. they can afford. So in many ways, I think it is concerning if you have, you know, the guardians and the parents or whatever of those children, because essentially that's what they are, who facilitate that. Mm-hmm. I think that's more where it's concerning, because at the end of the day, you know, my kids certainly can't come to me and say, can I have a Drunk Elephant thing? Because you're not getting it.
I think it's interesting as well, because it's kind of like when we were growing up, at least like our spaces were so separate from adult spaces. Yes. Like, for example, I remember my mum putting her eye cream on and just being like, I don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'd know what a lip gloss was or like something like that, because it'd be reflected in the things I was watching, mm-hmm. for example. But we weren't, I feel like beauty routines used to be quite a lot more hidden. Like, you wouldn't really necessarily admit to using an anti-aging thing or admit to this, because it would be seen as like, well, you think you're getting old or something. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? But do you think, I mean, I wonder, trying to steer it to the positive, if people getting, if like, yeah, children and teens getting so involved with the actual like granular, what it means to be aging, what it means to be this, will kind of throw up more radical ideas earlier on. Because surely if you're like, at one point, if you're like, look back and you're 13, you realise you're 10 putting on like a retinol, something's going to snap in you at some point.
Yeah, but I'm wondering whether it will, you know, whether them sort of starting that journey at 10, they'll just ride it for the rest of their days, you know. And I think it'll take a while before they sort of snap back and kind of think, actually, hang on a second, that's not quite right. I think the change sort of needs to come here at this point where, yes, you're not going to shift from the tweens necessarily not being interested in beauty. And that's not really the conversation. It's more about sort of educating them in many ways. I think looking after your skin is a great thing. I didn't really have that. I didn't have the information at hand around looking after my skin. All I knew was that it was breaking out and I didn't know what to do with it. And then I was just using all sorts of things on it, which were actually quite dangerous for your skin. But I didn't really know that. I didn't have that sort of education. There was nothing that, you know, you couldn't go on YouTube and find out, you know, what's going on with my skin, or just getting some sort of information or anything like that. And I think one thing we do have a lot of is a lot of good education out there on beauty. It's finding the right voices and the right people and so on. But I think that if we can channel that in a positive way, where the tweens are like, okay, well, I need to look after my skin. I don't need retinol right now, but maybe I need ceramides, or maybe I can just do with this or whatever. And then you're still enabling them to be able to sort of dabble in that love of beauty per se, but not in a way that becomes kind of detrimental or sort of negative to their own way of thinking about beauty.
I do also think the beauty industry, not the beauty industry, the beauty communities online can be some of the most inclusive spaces in online as well. Like, there's so much like queer representation for kids that if they are engaged in those communities, they might
be a bit more progressive than if they weren't, or if they were involved in beauty, interested in beauty at a few, even like a 10 years ago, they wouldn't have had like such an education in like Prague or something like that, that they get now through just that interest in products or interest in a lip gloss, and then that takes them down that hole.
I guess for me, it's more about where are we placing our value? You know, I think that beauty can be a really wonderful thing, but it should be something that one wears lightly, you know, where, you know, if you're wearing it and it makes you feel amazing, great. But on the days that you're not wearing it and so on, it should be fine. You know, so it's about where are we placing our values? And I think that's something that, you know, we need to think about with the 10-year-olds, whether it's a case of they want all of these different things because it makes them feel better, when really maybe there's an underlying issue that just needs to be explored quite separately to beauty. But I understand that, you know, certainly, you know, with beauty communities can be really, really powerful for people who have felt marginalized and not accepted in so-called normal spaces. It can be really, really powerful when you kind of find your people, you know.
Yeah, my mom's a massive fan of makeup. Like, I can't even explain. She's got like a chest of drawers that's just like one drawer is lip glosses. And she's been plus size. She's been plus size my whole life, and it's something that she's always been able to like put her passions into.
Yes,
because she's not catered to elsewhere within the beauty and fashion industry.
Yes, yeah, that's amazing. Yeah,
yeah, she's fab.
But yeah, I would say that there's like, I feel like there's a stark difference between, you know, like an eyeshadow palette and then like retinol or these ingredients that actually have like a scientific component, which I thought was also really interesting about the exhibition, was that it kind of traced the pharmaceutical beginnings of a certain type of beauty and how that kind of became cultural instead of scientific, which is something that I talk a lot about in my book as well, when like wellness and health become a lifestyle pursuit rather than something that is actually tied to, you know, us and our biology and our makeup and stuff. I feel like that's a very slippery slope.
Oh yeah, completely. I mean, weirdly enough, actually, I was having a conversation with someone just yesterday, and it was like, how is it that we've come to this point where wellness is, you know, equated with wealth? You know, in order to pursue wellness, you actually have to be quite wealthy. How is that when wellness is something that just should be for us all? You know, it shouldn't be about how much you earn or how much you can spend, you know, and really super expensive products and so on. But that's kind of where we are. So, you know, I totally hear you with that, how that has sort of shifted. It's no longer about, our sort of biology and sort of those sort of basic things that everyone can sort of relate to. It's more about, well, you can have this level of wellness if you can pay for it.
I feel like that's only increasing as well with, like, you know, the kind of, with Ozempic, basically, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. And like, you know, the introduction of these drugs or these things or like these little tweakments, as people call them, that are like very low effort in some ways, like in inverted commas, high price. That brings like a whole other class discussion into beauty, I think, in terms of like those who, I feel like we see it so often, like those who can afford good fillers aren't criticized for cosmetics work, whereas like those who maybe are going to the high street or whatever, and then like maybe are out in the club, and you know, one of those horrible pictures in the Daily Mail where it's like women gone wild at Ascot or whatever, like Ladies Day, because, and they'll, people will call those fillers janky because they're not like expensive enough, and that person like isn't going to the doctor that has like the acceptable face of it.
It's so shocking, isn't it?
Yeah,
really, when you think about it. And this it's an interesting one, you know, when we're talking about fillers and, you know, and tweakments and so on. On one hand, you do have that, you know, the people who are able to afford really expensive iterations of it, you know, they're sort of lauded for being this face of, you know, really good work. Oh, that's such good work. Or who's your doctor and so on. And someone else who can't afford that, like you say, you know, they're sort of criticized. But essentially, it's the same thing. Everyone's pursuing the same thing. You can go to the most expensive person, or you can go to, you know, your dentist and have Botox. I'm not advocating that. Please don't do that. But essentially, it's the same thing, because everyone is trying to fight age. and that is an issue. I think everybody who was doing that, that's the issue. And I know that some people are sort of criticized for having work done. I also think that's an issue.
Yeah.
Because, you know, us pursuing agent in, you know, at whatever cost, that is a problem because you can't fight aging. you just can't.
The one thing that's guaranteed.
You just can't fight it. So it's, you know, it's a lost cause. You can't, at what point are you going to sort of stop? And in many ways, you have to sort of, you know, confront this issue that, okay, we have an issue with aging. How do we deal with this? You know, and then on the other hand, you know, I think it's very much a choice. If someone wants to have lots of injections and they want to have tweakments and so on, that is a very, very personal choice. And everyone is on a different journey when it comes to self-acceptance in whatever way. And you can't sort of criticize someone who's not at a certain point mm-hmm. that you think that they should be. You just can't. Everyone's on a different journey when it comes to beauty.
I also think there's something in it about it seeming natural, like their work looks natural and their work doesn't look natural. Mm. And there's this obsession with that the best form of beauty is a natural beauty and then, like, pursuing it was immoral. I think it was kind of touched on in the beginning of the exhibition as well, of like people were kind of seen as like unjust or immoral or ungodly if they were overly obsessed with their own beauty.
Yes.
But the people who were naturally beauty, naturally in bunny years.
Yes, yeah.
were seen as like highly virtuous.
Yes,
like
yeah.
Method of thinking has continued today. Like, if you and that, like, all these sexist men who are like, oh, I love a girl who doesn't wear makeup,
yes,
showing a picture of a woman with like the most beautiful yeah. you've ever seen.
So true.
Weird obsession with natural.
Yes, beauty. Yeah. And this idea that, you know, the more sort of pious you are, and so it sort of shows on your shows in your skin. But yeah, I mean, some of the so-called beautiful people, for me, that I've met, like, lots of so-called, you know, people that society will deem really beautiful are some of the most hideous people I've ever met. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I this idea that we still like to correlate those two things, I just think it doesn't even make any sense. It really, really doesn't. But yes, I do think that it's because we put beauty on such a pedestal. That's the problem. You know, so we associate it. It's like, okay, if someone's really, really beautiful, you know, that's almost next to godliness, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's because we put it on such a pedestal. And it's that thing that everyone is, and I say that, you know, loosely, but, you know, people are just constantly sort of searching for.
I mean, I think it's so interesting as well. And something that the cult of beauty does really well is kind of like uncovers these roots in religion and like, yeah, godliness. Like, these are words we would not normally use if we were having like a conversation about beauty. Do you know what I mean? I feel like a lot of us, if you're not religious, feel like very divorced from like the influence of religion, maybe, where it's like, no, really, like a lot of these things lead back, not necessarily even just religion, but like, you know, like white supremacy, ableism. If you trace why you feel the way you do back to something, it's maybe something you don't agree with, which I think the exhibition does really well at interrogating as well.
Yeah, I couldn't believe how much people were interested in beauty from such a early...
I know, before they even had, like, proper mirrors.
Yes, yes, yes. That was really interesting, wasn't it? Yeah, no mirrors, but still... This is why I wonder whether it's something that's ingrained. Because we haven't been able to trace back to a time that people weren't interested in beauty. But maybe what's shifted is what our perception of beauty is and how that sort of manifests itself in many ways.
I think as well, is beauty is free before capitalism got involved, or the beauty industry got involved. Like, you used to be able to just look at a tree and be like, that's beautiful. That's
yes,
it was accessible to everyone, and not that I'm like a medieval peasant and I'm talking. But that would logically is where my mind would go.
Yes.
You can use your eyes to look at something beautiful, and that's a free act of joy.
But I think anything that is of benefit to, say, the human race or to society, there is always going to be someone who thinks, how can I capitalize on
exactly.
that?
Exactly. And that's what, you know, the whole problem has been.
Yes.
And I also think that, like, self-improvement is part of the human condition in a way. Like, we do want to be able to self-improve, and previously, or like maybe when you're reading a book, that person's trying to go on like a moral journey or like a journey in their relationship. But beauty is just another way to do that, like to aggressively self-improve. Which I think is why it's so, like, we're so divorced from beauty in the poetic sense that Gina said, and then the scientific sense, which is where I've been coming from, I suppose, with wellness and stuff, but we still conflate the two, I feel. I think, let me double check how long. I think we've been talking for half an hour. We've been talking for 40 minutes. Okay, we should wrap it up. I was trying to time keep so well. I absolutely fucked it. Okay. Any parting thoughts?
I could go on for hours.
I know.
I guess my part of the thought is how much of it is wrapped up in sexism as well. Like, beauty is so aligned.
And ageism.
Yeah, and ageism.
I think every ism, really.
Yes, it is. And I think that it's because it still goes back to the standard that everyone seems to, you know, the standard that society holds dear is all of those things, that it's not older. It's not someone who is disabled. It's not someone who has the so-called wrong color. You know, even when you see the way certain people in marginalized communities are depicted, whether in certain shoots or certain, you know, media landscapes or whatever, you find that it's always the acceptable face of. It's always, you know, okay, we can have someone who's bigger, but, you know, in the right places, you know, let it all be in proportion, let it all be, you know, let them look like Jessica Rabbit, you know, or whatever, you know. It's always so, I think that's the thing. You know, beauty is steeped in that. It's that standard. That standard still hasn't changed. It still hasn't shifted. A lot of the things that we're seeing is still really performative. And I think until we have those who are in positions of power and responsibility, until we get them to sort of shift their way of dealing with this and not putting everything down to sort of hard cash, we will continue to do this unless we as consumers stop and say, actually, we want to change. And then things will start to change.
Definitely. Perfect note to end on, I'd say.
Gorgeous.
thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
We will see the listeners next week.
See them.
Hear them. Talk to them. Yeah, that'll be us. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.